Information is available at 367-0300. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus 580, we will explore an often overlooked aspect of World War I, and that is the war in the Middle East. There was indeed a great deal of fighting that took place outside of Europe. In the popular imagination, when people think about World War I, I'm sure that's what most people think of, the trench warfare that took place in Europe. But there was fighting in places today that are Turkey, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Syria. And we'll be talking about some of that, at least one part of that, the Sinai and the Palestine campaign, this morning in this part of Focus. And our guest is David Woodard. He's professor of modern European and Russian history at Marshall University, which is in Huntington, West Virginia. And he has authored a recently published book that is entitled Hell in the Holy Land, World War I in the Middle East. And it's published by the University Press of Kentucky. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Folks who are listening and like to be involved in the conversation can call in one of two ways. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means no matter where you're listening, around Illinois and Indiana or around the United States, if you're listening on the internet, you may use the toll-free line and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL or 9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Woodard, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very well, thank you.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time.
I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I wonder why it is you think that people have such a limited kind of idea of the First World War. At least they probably don't know a lot about the fighting that took place outside of Europe. Certainly, there was a very important naval component, things that happened on the high seas that people don't think about. The one thing that I'm sure that most people think about is the European war, that the trench warfare that happened there. Why is it that you think that something like this, for example, the war in the Middle East, people just probably don't know anything about it?
Well, I think that's probably especially true of Americans, because we actually have only a limited time in combat on the Western Front when we get an army to Europe, and Americans, quite frankly, just don't focus on the First World War as they do on World War II or the war in Vietnam or certainly the American Civil War. If you go into a bookstore, you just really won't find that many works on the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of it. And then again, this was truly a sideshow compared to, you know, the gigantic forces that were fighting each other in the trenches of the Western Front, the huge casualty figures, the futility of that sort of, at least that's the popular imagination anyway, of this fighting. And the forces in Egypt and Palestine, even though substantial, don't come close in, you know, comparing it to the French forces and the British forces and later American forces fighting the Germans on the Western Front. That has sort of become the focus of the whole war, the Western Front, and people also tend to forget about the Russian Front.
Mm-hmm.
They don't pay that much attention to it, and there's that not that much literature in the English language. And I think that's another reason. Most of the literature that Americans have access to, of course, is in English, and that, I think, is another reason.
Mm. Well, it is true, as you say, that here, when we're talking about the Middle East, and particularly this part of the Middle East, we are talking about British troops, there were Australians, and then also in this region there were Russians, and there weren't American troops. We were not involved in that fighting.
No, about the only way we were, there were some Americans who joined some Jewish battalions in the very last stage of the war. This was after the Balfour Declaration. And when the British promised a Jewish state in Palestine, and you do have not a great many, but you do have some Americans along with other British and Jews from other parts of the world who fought in three Jewish battalions. even though they don't really see much combat, but they're there.
And that, pardon me, I was just going to say, and that goes to the question of why it is, in a sense, why it is that it matters, the fighting that took place here, why it matters. And it does go to the Middle East that we have today.
Absolutely. Initially, the British are primarily concerned about Egypt and the Suez Canal. You know, once they're in a war against Turkey in late 1914, and that's their primary objective, was to defend the Suez Canal. But they're also very interested in the oil that was near Basra in what was then called Mesopotamia, present-day Iraq. And so they get involved there fairly early in the war. They send a small force there to protect those oil wells that were vital to the British Navy. So this is where you have yet another campaign. And then, of course, later on, there was the idea of finding an easier way to win the war, and that perhaps was to send the naval force first to the Dardanelles. The idea was that they would send their great battleships into the Sea of Marmara and just put Constantinople under those big guns, and the Turks would surrender. Well, that was nonsense, of course, and in the end, the Navy can't do it, and so they get involved in Gallipoli with a fairly large force that included a lot of imperial troops, the Australians and New Zealanders. And so fairly quickly you have a number of these campaigns, but ultimately the most important one, in my mind at least, was the one starting in Egypt and then across the Sinai Desert and into Palestine. And then in 1918 they go to Damascus and beyond and destroy the Turkish army, driving Turkey out of the war.
And ultimately bringing the end of the Ottoman Empire.
Right. And the British, who had played the primary role in defeating the Turks, now play a very large role in drawing the map. Not without Arab participation. They're not necessarily innocent victims all of the time. But nonetheless, there were some promises made that were not kept. And I can assure you that many Arabs have never forgotten that. But they do things like create what in some respects was an artificial state in Iraq. They put some Turkish provinces together, three of them, the Shias and the Kurds and the Sunnis, and they draw some artificial borders as well, and we all know how important that is to the present. But there are other examples as well. And of course the French get involved. They had not really militarily played much of a role, but they historically had an interest in places like Lebanon. And so, they end up with Beirut and Lebanon at the end of the war. But this is when the West really comes into the Middle East in a very, very large way. And a lot of the animosity that exists today goes back to the Turks being pushed out, but being replaced by Western nations like France and Great Britain.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Woodard. He's professor of modern European and Russian history at Marshall University, and that is in West Virginia, in Huntington, West Virginia. And he's authored a book that looks at World War I in the Middle East. It's titled Hell in the Holy Land. It's published by University Press of Kentucky. We do have someone here who would like to come into the conversation.
Sure.
Certainly, people who are listening can do that. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. The caller is in Chicago, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that you should have a guest on about this because I have cable, and right now they're running a series on World War I, and they're concentrating on the Middle Eastern portion. And some people have compared the campaign in Gallipoli, for instance, to the campaign in Anzio a generation later. Very similar events in the sense that they land there in the beginning and nothing happens, and they don't take advantage of it, and it becomes a bloody event. It's interesting that in the Middle East, people don't realize what happened in the Middle East with the Turks and the Armenians, for instance, or they don't realize what happens in Russia. The fighting in Russia in World War I is just as bad as it would be a generation later in World War II, and they lose almost as many men. But I find it interesting that people also don't realize what happened in Africa. Everyone knows about Rommel in World War II with the Desert Fox. No. But they don't realize that in World War I there was a German general by the name of von Ledolf that just ran the English crazy in Africa, cost him a lot of casualties. They were colonial troops, but the fighting in Africa was bad then, and I wondered if you had any comment on that.
Well, you're right. There's a recent book out on the attempt to drive the Germans out of East Africa, and it's called the Forgotten Campaign or Forgotten War. And I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, but it's gotten really great reviews. But certainly, that's not on the radar screen for many Americans to even know that there was fighting between particularly South Africans and native troops. And, you know, Jan Christian Smuts makes his reputation there as a general. And when he comes to Britain, it was pretty much thought that he had wrapped up that campaign. But, you know, it actually, that's the last group of Germans to surrender. And it actually, they surrender after the armistice.
That's right. They had a general by the name of Paul von Lettow.
That's right. He was a fantastic guerrilla fighter, and that's one reason why he was able to be so elusive, and the British just can't finish him off.
That's right. They had a lot of colonial troops over there. Most of them were Indians.
Uh-huh.
Some African troops, and as a matter of fact, some of the men who served under von Lettow were African. People don't realize that. They think about Hitler, and they figure, how could that be?
That's right.
But
right.
It happened, and he had a lot of troops, and they ended up wiping out whole units, stealing supplies from their enemies and basically holding the British off until 1919 when he had a victorious parade in Berlin.
And this was a really tough campaign, just the natural environment for the troops involved. And this is so true, and this has been, I think, my emphasis in writing about Palestine and Egypt, is just what these British soldiers had to go through. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah, these are really the forgotten wars.
Right, right.
You have a number of these wars in history. I digress. You talk about the campaign in the Middle East. You're absolutely right. But then there's people don't realize that there's the Russo-Japanese War in 1945, and then again they fight in 38 and 39,
mm-hmm.
and then again in 45 when this general Vasilevsky takes 1.6 million Russians into Manchuria and drives the Japanese out. All of these campaigns somehow slip through the radar. I don't know why, but they just do.
Right.
Okay,
well,
thank you very much.
Very perceptive comment.
Well, thank you for the call. Let's go to someone else here. This would be line number one in Eureka. Hello.
Hi. A very interesting program this morning, David. I'd like to ask two kind of side questions, not about Middle East, World War One, but first of all, what you said about Iraq was extremely helpful, and my knowledge is just slight, only about one sentence that the British had divided into three sections, and I believe, as you indicated, it became independent in 1922. First of all, could you just give a slight background as to maybe the time and date and ways that Britain occupied or colonized Iraq?
Well, in 1917, they liberate Baghdad. Earlier, they had suffered a great humiliation because they lost an entire army trying to take Baghdad. But they're liberating Baghdad from the Turks. And, and you can go back and you can see what the British commander of that period says, and there's some similarities to what the Americans say when they reach Baghdad, that you know a new era has arrived, you're going to have better government, and so on and so forth. And they end up setting up a monarchy in Iraq, which In many ways, I think, was an improvement over what had existed earlier.
Mm.
But, again, you have foreigners in Iraq. You know, you have the British in Iraq. And there was, you know, very early on, there was going to be an insurrection against that British control. And one very controversial question, and this is a subject I don't know a great deal about, was whether or not the British used poison gas in order to suppress that insurrection. But, again, you know, they establish the monarchy in Iraq, and early, of course, they didn't create these different provinces. They just took these three Turkish provinces and put them together in the state of Iraq. But they had existed earlier as Turkish provinces.
Now, again, my knowledge of that era is very slight. I'm sure you're much more well-versed. Would the Ottoman Empire be the same as the Turks in dominating Iraq before 1917?
Sure. Sure. The Ottoman Empire, it wasn't what it had been. It had been in decline for a very, very long period. And, you know, of course, it can't survive the First World War. But this had been administered by the Turks for a very, very long period.
Second question, just because my father was born there. How geographically, to what extent did the Germans penetrate the Russian monarchy during the First World War?
I'm not sure I understand.
How far into Russia did the Germans get during the First World War? geographically?
Well, they drove the Russians out of Poland, and they have reached a line, if you go from Riga on the Baltic, uh-huh, and pretty much drop the line straight down. That was the line when the Russians signed an armistice in late 1917. Now, later on, when Russia's in chaos, the Germans send troops into the Ukraine. They send troops into the Crimea. But, you know, they're trying to exploit the resources of Russia to get around the Allied blockade.
Uh-huh.
But this is after the monarchy has fallen, and Russia's just in general chaos.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll go to line number two. This is someone in Indiana. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I would like for you, if possible, to talk about the map, how they drew the lines and things. I remember as a youngster, luckily I was a stamp collector, so the Middle East was sort of happening right in front of me, but I didn't know all the connections, but I did, know it was of existence. And I just wondered, oftentimes it's mentioned in books, how they just drew lines, but was there any sort of diplomatic history to this kind of drawing the line, so to speak? In the colonial period, I imagine they carved up a lot of places the way they wanted to. And I just wondered if there was a history to it, or whether they just sat down and said, we're going to go, 36 degrees this way and stop here. I just wonder if you could talk more about that. Thank you.
Well, this is something, of course, that I'm not really concerned with in the book that I've written. But it was sort of a balancing act, as I understand it. You of course, have the British and the French with historical interest in this part of the world. You also have Arab interests that have to be mollified up to a point. And so you have an area that had been just part of this vast Ottoman Empire, and it's collapsed now. So what do you do? And one alternative, of course, would have been to create a huge Arab state, but I don't think that's really ever in the cards, and I'm not sure the various Arab groups could have gotten along well enough to do that. And so instead, you have various states like Transjordan, you have Lebanon, you have Palestine, you have Iraq, and these areas were put together, and attempts were made to create, some form of government. What happened after the war itself and during the peace settlement is that these areas were set up as mandates, and the idea was this is not going to be old-fashioned imperialism as you'd had in the 19th century, where a European state just goes in and takes a piece of territory and adds it to their empire. Instead, these were going to be areas administered by the League of Nations, with the idea that in time they would become independent states. Now, no deadline or precise date was put on that, but in some respects it's just a gloss on 19th century imperialism. It's pretty much the same thing, but it does look a little bit different because of the so-called mandate system. But again, I'm getting into an area that I'm certainly no expert on.
Well, I appreciate you. You've responded now to some fairly wide-ranging questions, and I appreciate you responding to them. Let me again introduce the guest, David Woodard. He's professor of modern European and Russian history at Marshall University and is the author of a book that looks at World War I, specifically at World War I in the Middle East, and even more specifically, it was talking about something that's known as the Sinai and Palestine Campaign, fought by the British there. And he talks about it in his book, Hell in the Holy Land, World War I in the Middle East. It's published by University Press of Kentucky. I think one of the things that you stress, I believe, in the book that people want people to appreciate is when you look at the men who fought, particularly those who died here, we're talking about soldiers that were not regular army troops. They were part of the British Home Force. And I guess, as I read it, we're talking about something that would be kind of like the National Guard having been sent to fight in this place where conditions were very difficult. Were they in any way, these men, prepared? Could they, in fact, have in any way been prepared for just the environmental conditions they would have to deal with?
No, you could hardly imagine a place more different than the green fields and cloudy skies of Great Britain. I mean, it was like going to a different planet, almost. And, of course, some of these British soldiers were excited about going. Many, of course, had never left Britain. Many had not strayed too far from where they were born. And so it was an extraordinary experience to be put on a troop ship and shipped off, first of all, to Egypt. And suddenly you're in this really exotic city, but then you're going to have to end up with desert warfare. And it turned out to be an extraordinary campaign in that respect because, well, among other things, it's a waterless area when they're trying to cross the Sinai. There were some wells, but the water's brackish, and the British can't drink it, and their horses can't either. And so they somehow had to find a way to provide water. And the way they did this, for the most part at first, was through camels. They literally collected tens of thousands of camels. It's the largest camel force ever assembled in history. And they would put these drums on the back of camels. A camel could carry something like 24 gallons of water. And they also had to have camel drivers. And they end up recruiting something like 170,000 Egyptians. You know, many serve only briefly, but just to provide the soldiers with water. Now, eventually they put a water pipe across the Sinai. But that was, there's this thirst that I think British soldiers never forget. They just don't have enough water, particularly when they're campaigning. And in one remarkable battle, the first of their real fights in the Sinai, a battle called Romani, and the Turks have been driven back, and they're trying to catch them marching across sand. As many as 800 soldiers just die of thirst, the heat, and the lack of water. They just expire in a two-day march. Extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, I think it's certainly well worth mentioning that here the vast majority, in fact, almost all, I think, of the casualties were not due to people who were killed or wounded in battle. They were these various things that we're talking about. They were people that succumbed to the heat. They were people that got sick because of disease. It was all of those other sorts of things that can be associated with war other than battlefield injuries.
Yeah, that's particularly true in the very last stage of the war because there's the Turkish army is in really in a bad state by the time you get to September of 1918. And it really is no match for the very large imperial force that had been assembled in Palestine. But once the Turks have been defeated and driven back, there's this flu epidemic that hits the Western Front, but it also gets to Palestine, plus a malaria, terrible malaria, because the Turkish lines, they hadn't really dealt with malaria as they had on the British side of the line. And so a lot more British soldiers die from disease than from Turkish bullets during the last phase of the war. Mm-hmm. That's certainly true.
You talked about the importance to the British of access to oil in the part of the region here that is now Iraq. But in terms of military objectives, things that anyone would look at the map and say, well, this is strategically important and it must be defended. It seems that the only thing in this vast open desert region, really the only thing that constitutes a real military objective would be the Suez Canal.
That's right. And the Turks actually attacked the Suez Canal early in the war. It was sort of a quixotic attempt and really had no chance of success. But the British are in a state of panic over this because they simply can't lose the Suez Canal. And so what started out as sort of a defensive attempt to hold on to the Suez Canal and to extend defenses beyond the canal became an offensive movement. And we started looking at possible objectives that would boost home morale. I mean, clearly it's Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And so that brought back memories of Richard the Lionhearted and the Crusades and all of this. But that really concerns the British commander who takes Jerusalem to use expressions like crusade because, well, he's got a lot of Muslims serving with his Indian troops. He's also got a lot of Muslims who are the camel drivers and other laborers. And, he doesn't want to bring that up. Already the Turks have declared a jihad against the British. They do that when they declare war. And when they go to war in late 1914, they just don't go to war. They also declare a crusade, really, of the Muslims against the infidel. And Allenby didn't want the war to become that kind of war. And I think he's quite right in doing that. But I think that's just one more interesting aspect of this war. But here you had these British soldiers fighting in Palestine, marching by Bethlehem, going to the gates and walls of Jerusalem, and they were much more religious, I think, during this time than they are today. And so it was special in many respects, going to these biblical sites that they knew about from their Sunday school lessons and reading the Bible. And many carried Bibles with them, and they would consult those Bibles to really learn a little bit about the region they're fighting in.
Yeah. No, that this, again, gets at what I think is another interesting aspect to this fighting, and that is having successfully defended the Suez Canal two times against a Turkish attack, and having in the second case driven the Turks back some, it seemed that in terms of further strategic objectives, well, you have to ask exactly how important might it be to take and hold this territory and to drive the Turks back. And in fact, the British do continue to press on, and they take eventually taking Jerusalem and then going all the way to Damascus. But it seems that some of this, at least a big part of this, had to do with back home, as you say, wanting to get some good news, because there was no good news coming out of Europe. And the British government there was looking for the opportunity to say that they had won something, that they had had battlefield success. And so for that reason, then, particularly then Allenby was tasked to press on in the way that he did. And again, one might ask the question, well, just how strategic was this militarily, or was it just a matter of the British government wanting to find some place where they could say that they'd been successful?
Well, I think it's the latter for sure, that they want a military success. And, you know, how do you define military success on the Western Front in 1917? Look at casualty figures and say, well, we killed a lot of the enemy, and it had become sort of a dirty war of attrition. You just weren't going to have some sort of breakthrough, an advance of 100 miles to take Paris or move across the German border. You know, that's just not in the cards. It's going to take a whole series of battles for the Allies to accomplish that, to actually get to Germany's borders in 1918. And so, for sure, the British government, particularly the British Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, you know, he wanted Jerusalem. Its strategic value, well, you weren't going to get to Berlin by way of Jerusalem or Baghdad either. Mm-hmm. But, it was a clear-cut victory. And, of course, you got big headlines out of that and gave the British public, I think, some comfort, because, you know, when you think about it, 1917 had been a dreadful year for the British. They'd been involved in this, the popular name for the campaign is Passchendaele, after the last village captured. But yeah, it was fought in basically a swamp, because as soon as the artillery had done its job and the real battle began, the rain started to fall. And this was being fought in reclaimed swampland, and it quickly became a swamp again when the artillery destroyed the little dikes and canals and this sort of thing for drainage. And it was it's hard to imagine a battle fought under worse conditions than that. Mm-hmm. And at the end, well, the British have not really moved the line very far, and they suffered very heavy losses. Meanwhile, the French army is mutinied. That had happened earlier in the year. So, you know, the Allies need a victory, and Jerusalem was that victory, and in that respect, I think it's important.
Yeah. Well, just, and I promise I have some callers here I want to get to, but that just, it allows the opportunity to make one more point, though, that certainly people thought of, they knew that the fighting in Europe was terrible. The conditions were awful, that would be one of the last places in the world that you would want to be. And because of that, I guess that there was some perception, there was idea that if you ended up going to the Middle East, you'd be getting off easy. And that, in fact, it wasn't like that, that it maybe conditions were different. It wasn't the same kind of fighting. And as we discussed earlier, maybe your chances of being killed in battle weren't as great, but your chances of dying from something else associated with the difficult conditions under which they were living and trying to fight. Now, there, that's where the deaths occurred. And it was no cakewalk to be sent there. Maybe it might be marginally better than Europe, but it could really be, I think, a toss-up.
Right. I mean, you do have a better chance of living fighting in the Middle East, but among other things, is there's almost no chance of home leave. You're stuck there. You know, if you were in France, you got to go home, not infrequently, but not so for those stuck in Palestine. They were there for the duration of the war, and the kind of privations they suffered are just not the same as they were. You know, when you're fighting on the Western Front, you don't spend a lot of time actually in the trenches. You spend a lot of time behind the line. And there you can eat a decent meal, you can have a shower, you can do a lot of things, whether it's sports or whatever, and get away from the war a little bit. But the soldier in Palestine just doesn't have those same opportunities. I mean, even things like getting letters from home, they were very infrequent because the Germans are always torpedoing British ships carrying supplies, including letters.
Let's talk with some other callers here. We have some who have been patient, and we'll go first to Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Good morning, Professor. The first caller from Chicago brought up a myriad of different points, but the one that I'd like to address, if you can, is the Armenian Genocide of 1915, which is back in the news again. Now, to what extent did the French play a role in this? Because I believe that they occupied the old Armenian part of Turkey at that time and withdrew their forces, and that's when the genocide took place. Anyway, what do you know about that? Thank you for taking my call.
Well, again, this is a little beyond my expertise, but as I understand it, you know, the French really aren't involved. You have Armenians living in Russia, and you have Armenians living in Turkey. And there had been this growing animosity between the young Turkish leadership, and they are a reform movement, but they also are extreme nationalists, and they want to really protect the Ottoman Empire. And the result, and the genocide really happens during the war years, and it's fairly well reported by Americans who are in this area for a variety of reasons, some with aid missions, this sort of thing. But the Turkish government today denies that this ever happened. And that's what their history books say, and that's what the government says. And it's, I think, a real distortion of history because, I mean, this was the, you know, it's the start of the sort of genocide that we have in the 20th century, from the Armenian massacre to the death of millions of Jews during the Second World War. So, yes, it clearly happened, but I don't think the French had a particular role in that.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes, certainly the Armenian genocide is something that probably deserves a whole program in terms of why it's having so much trouble getting recognized in our own country. But what I wanted to ask about is the Balfour Declaration and
yes,
concurrent treaties that may have conflicted with it, and the legal status of those in terms, I realize, again, you're being asked to go maybe a little bit afield from your basic expertise, but I would just like you to comment on the nature of the conflicting promises that were made and the legal status of those promises. And I'll hang up and listen online.
All right.
On the radio, I mean.
Well, again, as I understand it, and this is something that I think I have one sentence in my book dealing with, that, you know, there were really important repercussions after the war because of this British military campaign. But the British, and this is part of the campaign, the British want Arab support, and they, you know, they're having to deal with Muslims, and they want Muslims to take on the Turks, who are also Muslim. But they enlist that support, sometimes with bags of gold, and of course Lawrence has a lot to do with this, but they also make treaties. And the French are involved in this. It's the British and the French and the Arabs, and they make various promises to the Arabs, and all of these promises are not kept. There's just no question about that. Now, I'm not sure that I've done a good job of answering your question.
Well, again, that might be another topic for another day and another
right guest.
Let me introduce again the guest that we have here this morning, David Woodard. He's professor of modern European and Russian history at Marshall University. Marshall is in Huntington, West Virginia, and he is the author of a book that is about World War I in the Middle East, particularly that part that's known as the Sinai and Palestine campaign, where British troops fought. His book is entitled Hell in the Holy Land, World War I in the Middle East. It's published by the University Press of Kentucky. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. What sort of, now, as we've talked, the your main focus, a real focus in this book, is to try to document the experiences of your average soldier, you know, what it was like to be there, and particularly doing that by looking at their own accounts that they kept and letters that they wrote and them talking about their experiences. One thing I'm interested in now, having talked about some of the political background here, is how did the people in the region, the non-combatants, the civilians, the indigenous people, feel about the British being there?
Well, there is going to be actually a revolt in Egypt after the war is over, which suggests what they felt about becoming an important part of the First World War. But when Britain goes to war with Turkey, they make the mistake of promising the Egyptian people that they were not going to involve them in the war, and they can't keep that promise because they need native labor, and they use some pretty sharp practices in recruiting camel drivers, for example. And the same is true of a native labor force, but you know, they simply it's a construction project in part, just getting across the Sinai Desert, because they've got to put down railway lines, they've got to put down a great water pipe to carry the water, and they don't have the manpower to do that. And so, they pay the Egyptians, but they're essentially sort of drafted into the army, and in some cases they're under military discipline, which included, they weren't supposed to flog these workers, but they have native overseers. And they didn't hesitate to use these big rhinoceros whips to beat these people, to make them work. And so, and of course, you have the presence of this large military force, sometimes drinking too much. The Australians actually riot at one point in Cairo, and this was another intrusion. And you also have the religious motivation as well. So, no, many Egyptians do not welcome the British with open arms. And there also is some hostility, but Adam is, he tells the British soldiers, you've got to behave in Palestine. In fact, he won't even let soldiers go into Jerusalem at first because, soldiers are great souvenir hunters, and he was really worried about what was going to happen to some of these sacred places. And so initially, the British army was barred from Jerusalem. Now, later on, they get to go in with officers, and they get to visit the religious sites, but they're chaperoned, in effect. And the British, of course, don't think a lot of, particularly the desert Arabs. You don't have a lot of water, and so it's interesting to me to read some of these letters, and they just couldn't imagine that, from their knowledge of the Bible, that these were some of the same people that they're reading about in the Bible, because here they are, they're living in hovels, they don't wash very often because of the water, there's all of this squalor, they generalize about them and think that they're going to be robbed by them, and so on and so forth. And so there is this sort of edge to the relationship, which usually happens anytime you send an army into an area and you have this clash of cultures, you are going to have some difficulties, and they certainly exist between the ordinary soldier and the natives of the areas.
Yeah. Well, you talked about earlier about the fact that one of the disadvantages, one of the ways, if you compare the European war with the war here in the Middle East, is that at the very least, soldiers who were fighting in Europe had the opportunity sometimes to go home, and that these soldiers that were here in the Middle East, a long, long way from home, they didn't get the chance, but they were in an almost legendary part of the world.
That's right.
With remarkable things to be seen, I'm sure. And in fact, there's a wonderful picture here. This is a photograph that's right on the front that shows an encampment of soldiers with their tents pitched here in front of the pyramids. There must have actually been some exciting opportunities for these men. I hesitate to put it in those sorts of terms, but actually to be tourists, to see a part of the world that otherwise they never would have gone there.
That's right. Now, there's one officer who writes a letter back home, and he says, here I am seeing the pyramids, and here I am in the middle of this great city, Cairo, very exotic city, and basically it's all free. That's before he went into combat. But there's no question about it that there was no theater for the British Army that was as interesting from the perspective of a tourist as this particular theater, particularly if you were in the area of Cairo. And it's quite different being stuck in the middle of the Sinai Desert or in the Judean Hills. But yes, no question about it.
Well, let's talk with some other people here. We have next a caller in Rankin. This is on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello. Is the caller there on line 4? I guess they changed their mind. How about we'll try Savoy, line 1. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest had come across references about the use of mustard gas and other poison against the Kurds in Iraq that was favored by Winston Churchill. Churchill campaigned for the RAF to drop mustard gas on recalcitrant tribesmen in Iraq. In 1919, when he was Secretary of State in Britain's War Office, he urged the use of mustard gas against insurgents, saying he could not understand the squeamishness about the use of gas. And later, writing about it, he said it was absurd to consider the use of poison gas as an issue of morality, especially in the light of the fact that it had been used in World War I without a word of complaint from the moralists or the church, unquote. Is that...
Well, I think there's one thing, using poison gas against soldiers and using poison gas against civilians, I think you're on a different moral plane.
Well, it's kind of hard to separate them when they're living in the same area.
That's exactly right. And I think, again, as I understand it, the British do use, as I mentioned this a little earlier, they do use gas to, not in great quantities, but there were instances in which they used poison gas in trying to control Iraq after the war. I think that's certainly true. They also use it. It didn't work very well. They tried it against the Turks when they were trying to take Gaza, but the wind was so strong and it's a very arid climate, and the Turks don't even know they use poison gas, and so they just had to abandon that. But no, they actually used it on the battlefield as well.
Uh-huh. Blowback.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Now, I'm sort of confused on this point. I don't want to drag this out, but I guess my understanding was that while it is true that Winston Churchill had authorized this use of chemical weapons against the people who were rebelling in, I guess, what is now Iraq, that actually they never were used. Is your information that in fact they were used?
Well, I wish I could remember my source, but I have read recently that yes, indeed, that they did use not great quantities, but gas was actually used, and I've read the same thing that you've read, that no, it wasn't used, but then and again, I wish my memory is a little better on this subject, but the last thing I read said that yes, some of it was used.
Okay, well, I guess I'll have
but
to.
But I can certainly be corrected on that.
Well, not very long ago, I actually talked with someone who wrote a history of chemical warfare from World War I to the present, and now I'm. I guess I'll have to go back. I'd better go back and check to see. Let's see. We have another caller here. This is Champagne. It's line number 1. Hello.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
I know of an instance of a person that did get gassed over in France. He was one of the first of the American soldiers that went over there, and they didn't keep records or anything. They just put them in a certain place, you know. And they stayed at night in a basement where there had been gas. Now, evidently, it goes down. I always thought it went up. Anyway, as a result, they all got some of that gas in their lungs. And years later, he went into emphysema, and he always had problems. He had to go on disability and everything. But it was a result of the gas. But since our American soldiers had just been handed over to the French government, they didn't have records of them or anything.
Well, they used different gases.
So it took a long time for them to get... acknowledge that he had been gassed in the war.
A lot of people are not actually killed by this poison gas, but
yes,
they are disabled, and they have problems years later, particularly respiratory problems. But, you might have survived being gassed, but that didn't mean that you were going to have a healthy life in the future. But there were different kinds of chemical warfare with different properties. They had... phosgene, and they had chlorine, and they had mustard gas, and, you know, some would attack your, you know, they would blind you, temporary blindness in many cases, and anywhere you perspired or had moisture, it would, you know, be horribly irritated and would hurt you, and others would attack your lungs. So they used it. Fortunately, they didn't have sarin, which, would, of course, would have been absolutely deadly. But it is, looking back, it's extraordinary how much, and of course we use chemical warfare, that countries just did it as a matter of course once they had it. But there is a sort of stigma against using this chemical warfare, thank goodness. And it wasn't used in the European theater in the Second World War.
Mm-hmm. I think, though, the reason, again, going back to this recent conversation that I had with this man who'd written this history of chemical warfare, it seemed that the reason that it wasn't used in World War II is that both sides were afraid of the other side. That is, they were each afraid to be the first to use it because that would give the other side the reason to retaliate in kind. And I think that this was perhaps a case where the fear of the use of the weapons, well, on the German side, they actually had them. On the Allied side, they actually didn't.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think Hitler worried that the Americans and the British did, and they would do a better job of delivering than he possibly could. So in a way, he would only lose by using chemical warfare.
So that was one of the interesting questions there about chemical, the history of chemical weapons is that even though the Germans put a lot of effort into developing them and had them and had these very deadly substances, they didn't use them because they were afraid of what the other side might do in way of retaliation if they
did. Well, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah. We have maybe about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Questions are certainly welcome. I thank the last caller. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, as we've said a couple of times here, I think that your interest in writing this particular book was to, first of all, to give some attention to a part of World War One that doesn't get a lot of attention, and also to devote some attention to what the experiences were of the average soldier and how it is they talked about those things in their own words. Tell me some more about what the experiences of soldiers were.
Well, you know, among other things, you had those terrible sand flies, the tiny little flies that would, after taking blood, they would lay their eggs, and it would quickly turn into a festering sore. And it's my understanding that some American soldiers in Iraq have had some of the same problems. They called it the Baghdad boil. Then, of course, you had lice, you had scorpions, you had your regular flies, you had which led to a lot of septic sores. You had, for much of the war, a pretty meager diet, particularly when you were campaigning. The British had a stew, McConaghy stew, which was basically a lot of fat with some turnips in it. It was pretty gosh awful. They'd mix onions with it, but that didn't make it much more palatable. And then, of course, they had their biscuits, which was like eating a dog biscuit. They really learned tea was probably the best thing they had when they were actually on the march. But from food to natural obstacles to the heat, you know, the list goes on and on and on. I mean, it was an extraordinary campaign for these soldiers. And as you pointed out earlier, these were the true citizen soldiers, because before the war they had decided to be part of a home force, hadn't gotten much training really, but they do allow themselves to be sent abroad during the war, and Britain, which didn't start the war with much of a military, you know, desperately needed them, and so they tended to use their regular army in France, and they used these soldiers in Egypt and Palestine.
So it really was, and I was right in thinking that the territorials would be kind of like the National Guard.
That's exactly right.
Hmm. I don't know to what extent you had the opportunity to learn anything about what these men's lives were like after the war was over and they got a chance to go home. Are there any examples that you can think of ways in which men's lives were really the course of their lives were changed? They took a different path because they had this experience?
Well, I had a correspond with those who had copyright for these various letters and diaries and this sort of thing. And, you know, in some cases, there was one sort of leading figure, Doug Calcutt, who was certainly, he had not volunteered. He'd been drafted into the territorials as a replacement and sent over. And he doesn't really like war, but he plays a leading role in what I've written. But believe it or not, his daughter is still alive, and she wrote me a wonderful letter talking about her father, who became very successful in business. And she has memories of him complaining when he was cutting his grass during the Second World War because of German shrapnel was ruining his lawnmower because of the bombing campaign. But you know, he seemed to be an extraordinary fella, and he lived until his early 90s. But you know, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to actually talk, obviously, with any of these soldiers. Mm-hmm. They're pretty much all dead. There are just very, very few survivors now, as you can understand. And nor did I really get a chance to talk with family members. I corresponded with some, but I didn't get any face-to-face meetings with them.
Yeah. Well, it's a very interesting story, and I think certainly is an important, as we said, an important dimension of the war, World War One, and something that at least people should know about. It may not, in strategic terms, it may not have been hugely important, but in terms of the total experience of the war, it is important. So we really appreciate you taking some time and talking with us about it today.
Well, I appreciate the invitation.
Our guest is David Woodard. He is professor of history of modern European and Russian history at Marshall University. That's in Huntington, West Virginia. And his book, if you would like to read it, is titled Hell in the Holy Land, World War One in the Middle East. It is published by the University Press of Kentucky. Focus 580. This program is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. The broadcast is also made possible today with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and new seasonal dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week. A little later today, some conversation about the history of the Republican Party and the efforts of women to shape the party. Celeste Quinn will talk with historian Catherine Rimpf. She's the author of a recent book entitled Republican Women, Feminism and Conservatism from Suffrage Through the Rise of the New Right. That'll be on the Afternoon Magazine today in the 1 o'clock hour. The next hour of this show, we'll be talking about birds, bird watching and bird feeding, and our guest will be Larry Keller from Wild Birds Incorporated in Champaign. First, though, we'll break for